Group meeting, Friday, 21st May, 1982. I think we all know how much the senses and sense functioning has been depreciated by religious people. They have always talked in terms of beware of the senses. Yes, there is a certain rightness in that, but I think that there is much more mistaken thinking in relation to the senses throughout the millennia, actually. If we didn't have the senses functioning freely and rightly, the world would be in a very much worse state than it is now. And I feel very strongly that religious living and yoga is only another word for religious living in the real sense, not mere exercises for the body. It's not just a keep fit system. It is a complete teaching about religious living. Well, religious living and yoga require us actually to use our senses fully and rightly. We must note carefully to use the senses, not to indulge them. And the difficulty with the whole world is that it is hell-bent on indulging the senses in some form or other. We have to learn to allow the senses to function freely. We talk about training the senses. Now, there is definitely a right aspect involved here as far as training the senses is concerned, especially in the fields of science and the acquisition of necessary knowledge for worldly living. One has to train the senses there. In a laboratory, for instance, if our senses were not trained to observe, then science could not get along at any speed at all, because one would be trying to discover anew that which has already been discovered. So we have to be taught what to look for. This is quite an important point. We have to learn that. You see, what to look for. But if one's sense of sight is being trained in the usual meaning of the word trained, you might only see what you are supposed or expected to see. You won't see truly. The actual use of the senses, the right use of the senses, will be inhibited. Now that doesn't take us anywhere. Because if we train ourselves to inhibit the senses, we will always come across psychological difficulties. there will always be inner conflicts and so forth, because the functioning of the senses will arouse certain wishes, certain desires, and so on. And we are taught to beware of the senses and so forth, and we would just repress them. And we miss a very great deal. In fact, we cannot learn in the true sense, in the true meaning of the word learning, unless we can use our senses fully and rightly, freely. Freely use our senses, not indulge them, never indulge them. It's the indulgence, this self-indulgence, which is the factor which spoils all religious living and social stability and harmony and relationship. If we learn to allow our senses to see, then they will not work mechanically. Look at the sphere of art, of beauty, in any shape and form, especially the beauty of nature. You know how right from childhood the statements of our elders around us condition us. Isn't that a lovely flower? Isn't that a beautiful color? Marvelous sunset and so forth. All right, we say these things and we are conditioned in a certain way. But if from childhood we are allowed to see clearly, fully, and let the sense function freely and totally, then our aesthetic sense will grow naturally and uniquely. Uniquely meaning that it will apply to the particular person as such. It will be his or her aesthetic sense which is at work. Instead of being told that, oh, this is a beautiful flower or something, it may not be to that person at first. Let the child grow into the understanding and realization of its beauty. And when that happens, the sense of beauty which will grow from within the child will be one of the most powerful spiritual factors for that child growing to adulthood in the right way and coming to fruition in his or her lifetime. This is very important. Let there be no inhibition upon the sense functions right from the beginning. Also, if, for example, we let our eyes learn to see freely, we will develop the capacity for seeing precisely what is there. It will grow. And it's the same with hearing. Take, for instance, music. Supposing we are born with a certain natural sensitivity to the great masters of music, Bach onwards to, say, Brahms and so on, you see. If we have any sensitivity along that line, just listening to the music will enable us to let our aesthetic sense, where hearing is concerned, grow freely. Right. But if we are told and conditioned in this way, oh, this was the greatest composer, and that is not such great music, and so forth and so forth. We are told, listen for this, wait till it comes. It'll come in the development section at bar 25 or whatever it is, you see, and you will hear it and so forth. If we are taught that way, this comparative way, we will not be able to hear freely and wholly. It will be an unholy hearing. The expectation and the comparison and the depreciation of this or the appreciation of that, all that comes in and spoils the reality of the thing. I've been through this through my own personal experience, so I know how it is. One can hear a work 100 times, and if we have allowed ourselves to hear in the right way, then at the 101st time, it will be quite a new work. And we will always penetrate into new beauty. And this I have found very much from my own personal experience of listening to performances. You see? Also, one develops open-mindedness. If there isn't open-mindedness, then things are not so good. One has to be free and open. And this sort of development of open-minded functioning of the senses is something which enhances our capacity to respond in the right way and our capacity to understand and to be compassionate always. There is the true love of music, for instance, or of painting or poetry or anything, seems to me to involve loving the thing, you see. And there really can be no end to loving the thing as such. No end to it at all. But if we have these fixed ideas that, oh no, this is the way to do it, or that is not the way to do it, and so forth, we inhibit the whole thing, spoil it. Now, let us consider, from what does the indulgence of the senses derive when we are grown up? It derives from greed for sensational delight. So we indulge the senses. And we can indulge the senses in the name of culture and all that sort of thing. Similarly, we can indulge intellectually. I know how much during my lifetime I have suffered from intellectual greed. I read because I was just greedy to know. And what did I know after all? At the end of it all, after I was practically 70, 10 years ago, after I was 70, I discovered that the one thing I did know was that I did not know. I thought I knew this and I knew that and I knew the other. No, I didn't. Because when one lets the mind be quiet and open, then the growth within the mind is absolutely unbelievable. There's an expansion, and there is also at the same time a diminution, you see. A diminution in the sense that one's ego sense and so forth disappears. If and when that disappears, As the Buddha put it, he who doth crush the great conceit, I am, this indeed is happiness. You see, when that I am disappears, and the openness remains, the existential being, the psychophysical organism, becomes the apparatus for all that is spiritual, that is wonderful, that is beautiful, that is good in the real sense, not only for oneself, but for one's whole environment and society, just flowers out. You see? And one becomes more and more peaceful and quiet within oneself. So, this greed for sensational delight is one of the great roots of the indulgence of the senses, and it makes us slaves of our pleasure drive. I mean, every day of our lives, TV and the papers and this and that, we are bombarded with influences about how wonderful this is, and the advertisements which actually say, oh, now you can get this for £100.99 instead of £101. Run for it, they say. Run for it. Well, I ask you, to what depths of absurdity have we sunk? Well, the pleasure drive, if gratified, will give temporary pleasure, perhaps. Not always, but it reasonably often it'll give pleasure. But it will also contain the seeds of pain, disappointment, anxiety, and sorrow with it. It's an extraordinary thing that every gratified pleasure brings about some sort of pain and grief afterwards. It may be a little while afterwards, it may be 50 or 60 years afterwards. But it will do that. At least that's how I have experienced things. You see? Now, in contrast to the indulgence of the senses, right use is rooted in intelligence, whereas indulgence is rooted in ignorance, folly, weakness of character, and lack of self-knowledge. A factor which is necessary, which has to be present in order to make full and right use of the senses, is paying attention to the present actuality. Whatsoever is happening actually, whatsoever is actually present here now, is what we have to observe with our sense, through our senses. We have to observe that very carefully. And when we do that, then when we sort of learn to do that, then in due time the full use of the senses takes place naturally and spontaneously. No effort is required. The psychophysical organism is functioning healthily in the psychical sphere, just as when the body is ordinarily well, it functions well in the physical sphere. You see? But it takes place naturally and spontaneously. Thus, whereas indulgence is self-centered action, right use of the senses always brings about selfless action. Paying attention means that we set up the right relationship between ourselves and that which is being conveyed to us through the senses. Right relationship. When we indulge our senses, or when we pursue sensational delights and so forth, there is always a wrong relationship set up because of the intense self-centeredness involved in it, a grasping for something. Pleasure in the true sense, happiness in the true sense, will inevitably come if we only let it come. That's the whole point. The world is so constituted, in actual fact, unless, of course, one is in Antarctica. but putting aside such situations, normally, anywhere in the world, there is so much that pours in happiness into our being through the sense avenues. Sight, sounds, tastes, touches, perfumes, all these are sources of sheer joy and happiness for the organism. And because there is no grasping involved, there is no dust and ashes feeling afterwards. No feeling of depression that, it is over now, it is gone. You see, this is a thing that very few human beings understand. We who are interested and concerned with living the religious life, if we look at our own lives and our own urges, which arise from the pleasure drive inside us to indulge the senses and so forth, we will be surprised if we are really mindful all the time to discover how common we are. Even intelligent people will argue against this sort of view. Saying, but that is how human beings are. And they'll say, well, why shouldn't we have our pleasures and this, that, and the other? There's no question of why shouldn't we at all. No question. Have your pleasures and see what happens. But also enjoy the pleasures and the happiness that the world as a whole does give you freely without your grasping for it. You see, and see the difference. In the absence of grasping, there is health and real happiness. There is no loss. There is no depression. There is no feeling, oh, what a pity I missed that. Now, why didn't someone tell me that this was being shown or performed or done? How absurd. It'll come again. The magic and the beauty of the dawns and the sunsets and the starry nights and so forth, and the cloudy nights too, is there always throughout one's lifetime. Why be concerned to grasp it? Let it be. I can say quite honestly now, at this age, that whenever on the radio or the TV, even if the last quartets of Beethoven I miss, or some wonderful music of Mozart or Bach or anybody, I don't miss it. It's all right. when one is free, one is no longer imprisoned. The spirit, the golden winged bird, as put in the Rig Veda, is free to rise into the world of the eternal. And there is such a peace and a strength and a joy that whatsoever the manifested world can give us is absolutely nothing compared with it. In fact, you can't compare, because the world of the finite and the mortal cannot be compared with the realm of the infinite and the immortal. Cannot. We human beings are very funny that way. We compare because of our greeds, because of our ego and our vanity and so forth. Oh, this is better, I'll have that. You see? And have it at the least possible price. Now, when the senses, therefore, are operating properly, because we pay due attention and there is the right relationship present, we must inquire, what is it that spoils that relationship? Well, obviously the first thing that would come to mind is imperfect observation. What makes for imperfect observation? Well, again, obviously, lack of proper attentiveness. We are not using our senses properly, fully, freely, without being spoiled by preconceived notions of what this, that, or the other ought to be, or condemning it, or appraising it and being attached to it, and so forth. Lack of full attentiveness. Then, of course, there is the wrong interpretation by the brain. Now, there we are, practically all of us in the world, are at a slight disadvantage right from the start, because the world being what it is, hardly any parents in the world know how to let the child grow. They don't know anything about it. They may be first-class gardeners and do the right thing by plants, but they cannot do the right thing by a living human being, because they have never done the right thing by themselves. And so they are spiritually dark. That is the point, you see. So the brain is bound to interpret wrongly, because so many criteria, values, evaluations, and so on, they are all sort of fixed. This is what it ought to be, and this is how one ought to behave, and this, that, and the other, and this is how one ought to appreciate it or depreciate it, as the case may be. Then one cannot accept life in its wholeness. There will always be the arousal of hate and all that is attached with hate, fear, depression, anxiety, and all that sort of thing. There will be the arousal of hate at what is conveyed to us through the senses. You see, or there will be the arousal of wanting to grasp. And if we grasp at anything, we imprison that, and that imprisons us. When I hold something in my hand is also being held by that. Consider, for instance, in the millions of marriages all over the world, they hold each other. and in the holding each other, the true relationship of creative love is absent. The unconditional and total giving of oneself leaves the other as well as oneself perfectly free. Perfectly free not to do what one likes. That is the curse of humanity. I'll do what I like. It's the real curse of humanity, and particularly of the developed countries, the individualistic countries, under the excuse of the freedom of the individual, the freedom of this individual X means the suppression of the destruction of the freedom of that other individual. Why? It's like that. But we don't see this. Whereas if we do remain free, then we will be able to understand everything, good and evil. And then we will know the art of not resisting evil in such a manner that it transforms into the real good. And you and I and anybody in the world, what do we know of the real good? An enlightened being like the Buddha or any of the great spiritual teachers, those who had really really realized spiritual freedom, complete spiritual freedom, liberation from all that binds and hurts, they were able to understand life in this manner. Therefore they rejected nothing and nobody. You know that lovely story. It is not just a story, this is one of the actual facts. In the lifetime of the Buddha, when that robber Angulimala, he was a proper first-class murderous thief, you see, came along whilst the Buddha was walking through the forest. And he thought, well, now here is somebody, I'll kill him and take whatever he has. And Angulimala, and the Buddha, seeing him coming and knowing who he was, what he was like, that is, just filled his mind with compassion, with loving kindness, and directed it to Angulimala. He was called Angulimala. Mala means garland, and Anguli means finger. And this robber used to cut off the fingers of those whom he murdered, and he made a garland. It was a very long garland too, you see. So he was an expert at his job. Well now, Angulimala soon found that he was unable to keep pace with the Buddha. He couldn't get at him. So he got interested and started talking. And before the conversation ended, it probably was not a very short conversation, but the Buddha always had infinite patience with everybody. At the end of the conversation, Angulimala became converted to the Buddha's way of life. And he became one of his great disciples. There is that story. And I remember in another context, I don't know whether any of you ever saw that film which Cecil B. DeMille, who was a great producer, produced on the life of Christ. Called it King of Kings. And Mary Magdalene comes up to him, you see, to seduce him. and Jesus just looks at her. And that was the end of all seduction. And she became, well, she became what she became. You see, it's like that. Of course, another thing which makes for, which spoils the relationship, is defective sense organs. If one is born with defective sense organs, or one, any of the sense organs become defective, then, and it can't be cured, well, then one can't do anything about it, more or less. So there's nothing more to say about that. Then the other thing is vested interest. That spoils relationship very much. And pure observation. If we have a vested interest, then we want to see or hear this, that or the other, and we reject everything else. I know how many precious hours I have wasted in my lifetime trying to remember where I read something, because it was important for me for preparing a particular lecture or writing in a book or some such thing. And I would just go through page after page of book after book, you see, trying to find that particular thing. Vested interest. So I did not have the right relationship with that particular book or with any book, you see. And that spoils one's work. Vested interest, and then there are conditioning factors making for wishful seeing and hearing. These conditioning factors are the very devil, really. The way they spoil our whole living process. And our daily living process is impossible without the use of our senses. Now, once again, with regard to wrong interpretation, it is perhaps due mainly to our own prejudices, our preconceptions, and our assumptions, and so forth. And these are induced by persuasion by those we love or admire or trust or esteem. Oh, the master has said this, so and so has said that. And see what consequences follow. We never know what on earth the master was trying to convey, because minds are individual. The content of the mind of A, when he tries to convey it to B, will be interpreted by B in his own way, according to what he himself perceives and wants to perceive. You see? So all this has to be taken into account where the use of the senses is concerned. Now our biases, there is this element of bias. Now a bias may be of a nature which allies it to prejudice, or it may be a natural bent, as we call it. You see, one is born with a natural inclination this way, because he is going to grow up into this kind of person, you see. So our natural bias has its influence in the way the brain interprets what is conveyed by the senses. Look at the way in which we say, I think it must be because of something. I think it must be. But do I know that it is because of this, that, or the other? But I will say that because it's my natural sort of prejudice, or due to some preconception or assumption inside me. And then, especially when we are young, how we argue with each other. I'm sure that this, that, and the other case. And all these sureties vanish with the years as they pass by. If they grow at all, that is. The very positive assertion, it cannot be due to any other reason but this. Really? And for instance, when people start arguing about God, of course there is God, the one person says. Of course there is God. Well, perhaps if he's accustomed to have afternoon tea with God time and again, then there would be some real reason for him to say so. But there it is. And if one looks into this God, which that person's talking of, and if he can look into it himself, he will see that it is a projection of himself in apotheosis. You know, it's a curious thing. I remember in my school days, when my schoolmates used to argue about these matters with me, I discovered that the aspect of God which appealed most to them was the almightiness of God. Now that's very significant. Powerlust. And look at the way the world, the whole world through the millennia has pursued wealth and power at the expense of love and wisdom. The real curse of the activities, on the activities of the whole of mankind, is this insane pursuit, this devilish pursuit of wealth and power before one has realized even a modicum of balance between compassion and wisdom. That is why through the ages man has invariably and inevitably misused both power and wealth. Now, if and when we use our senses attentively, there will arise from us either mere reaction or right response. Mere reaction arises because of all the conditioning and so on, you see. But a right response arises if we can be quite open-minded and just observe rightly without talking back at what we are observing, without getting attached or getting repelled by what we are observing. Let there be pure observation, and in that pure observation there is whole containment, the containment of the totality within that observation. And in that sort of containment there is the end of all hate and disruption. The end of ill, if you like.